I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Catherine Bray.
And I'm Jack King.
On the show this week, it's the first of our Venice specials, and the three of us will be discussing some of the most talked about titles that premiered on the Lido. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. You'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Welcome, welcome to you both. Listeners, if you can hear the sound of crashing waves and a thousand Woody Allen debates, it's because true to the tradition started last year, we're coming to you direct from the Venice Beach to talk about some of the best titles from the Film Festival's 80th edition. Well, I mean, guys, as podcastings go, this is a pretty picturesque one. It's, you know, we did this last year and we're hoping that people like the ambient sound of the beach, but I mean, at least for us, this is fantastic.
We should paint people a bit of a picture here. Jack's sitting in his sunglasses and his little white shorts. Layla's in a bikini. I've got a vodka soda. It's all very convivial.
I'm just going to contribute to this very cinematic image by sipping my Aperol Spritz, as you describe it. Yeah, I know. I was just thinking, as you were introing us, Layla, I think this might be my fourth time on the podcast, but it's also the first time that we've done it in person. So, I mean, I think like that makes for better conversation anyway, because Zoom is stuttering and starting and all that kind of horrible digital stuff. And also, we're on a beach. We're on a beach. It's great. It's stunning.
We're on a beach,
yes.
We're
currently looking at people, you know, wandering around with their wonderful tan lines and stuff, soaking up the rays, putting their feet in the water.
Yes.
Drinking alcohol. It's great.
Yeah. I can't remember how many times I've done this podcast now, but last time was to talk about the god-awful Meg 2.
Which I think was filmed here, looking at the sea.
Which, yeah, this would have been an appropriate setting. And I hope it's also appropriate to share that Layla has a shark's fin tattoo. So I think every time I come on the Little White Lives podcast, we are going to talk in some small measure about sharks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there are any sharks in the water. A couple of jellyfish, perhaps. But, I mean, it certainly isn't like a massive chore. We're kind of in the shadow of the Hotel Excelsior, which is like the famous place on the Lido where all of the stars stay. And they kind of rock up on boats just across the bridge and kind of wave at people in their suits, gowns and Panama hats.
On the subject of sharks, we should also just quickly mention that obviously Maestro is here and Leonard Bernstein wrote West Side Story, which famously has the jets and the sharks.
Hey!
There's my through line for the day. I will have no other good thoughts.
I love West Side Story. This is fantastic. Now my tattoo has two meanings.
Hey,
very appreciated.
There we go.
But there's been quite a selection of films that have happened at this festival. It's, some high highs and some low lows, but to kick us off, Catherine, do you want to talk about one of the early ones that was screened, which was Michael Mann's Ferrari?
Yes, something funny happens at a festival, I think, where things that happened 2 days ago feel like they happened 2 years ago. So I'm casting my mind back for this one. But Ferrari, it's a Michael Mann film. It's the first one he's made in a while, so we're all really excited for it, with also that sort of sense of caution when somebody's returning, having not made any films for a bit. But this one's a banger. It stars Adam Driver as Enzo Ferrari, sort of fetching salt and pepper hair. Mm-hmm. The year is 1957. And I guess the thing to know going in, which I didn't really, I wasn't aware of, is that the Ferrari company was initially set up really to win races. It's a race car company, and the idea of it as a luxury sports goods company is kind of what comes along later. So this, we're purely in the world of the racing and of Enzo Ferrari's complicated love life.
Yeah, speaking of his complicated love life, some of the controversy I have heard is that people didn't buy Penelope Cruz the picture of Spain in many ways as an Italian.
Well, I gotta disagree. I think she made a wonderful Italian because, and I'll tell you exactly why, that what sold it for me is that Penelope Cruz, who plays Adam Driver's wife, Enzo Ferrari's wife, long-suffering wife, you know, it's one of those marriages where they got married super young and they've kind of grown up together and now he's off having sexy affairs with other women. Yeah, he has an extramarital child. And so you sort of see in Penelope Cruz's performance the toll that this has taken on her. And the particular detail that I loved that she has down is she has the walk of an old Italian woman. There's this sort of particular kind of like business where she's stiffened her hips a little bit. Because we've all seen Penelope Cruz being as sexy as you like in any number of other roles. And I think of her as quite a physically fluid person. You know, the hips roll and she's one of the sexiest women alive. And in this, she's stiffened that walk. Mm. And it's like you can feel the sort of the bitterness that this character has been pushed into by her husband's choices. I thought she was extraordinary.
Yeah, no, I completely agree as well. I thought she was fantastic. I mean, I know that, like, Ferrari has been... I detected kind of like it was a bit polarizing. I mean, I really appreciated it too. But if there is any consensus, I felt that it was around Penelope's performance. But one of the things I really like about the biopics I've seen here, or a trend that I've detected, is that, like, they're not trying to convince you that they are credibly the person they're portraying. So Adam Driver as Ferrari is like House of Gucci, fingers pinching kind of Italian, like vaguely xenophobic, would probably, you know, like will offend the Italian government at some point. But it's great. And it's like so performative and theatrical. And it reminds you that these are people playing for us. Like they're just having a bit of fun on camera. And I felt the same with Penelope Cruz, and when we talk about Maestro in that later, like it's the same kind of idea, I think. I enjoy that personally more than like somebody like deeply trying to convince you that they are the person. Like,
yeah, I mean, yeah. Obviously there are exceptions to this in the sort of arena of people playing different races, that kind of thing. There are big exceptions to this, but in general, and where we're talking about like Penelope Cruz playing an Italian, I would say let actors act.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I fully agree. And it worth bringing in that, I mean, this was one of the films that actually had an exemption. They had an interim deal. So we did get to have the stars kind of coming out and Adam Driver sitting and doing panels and talking to people, unlike most of the American films. Mm. And
yes,
he gave an amazing
speech. This is the Venice of the strike. The big strike. Yeah. No actors, except when there are actors.
Yeah.
Yes, when Benicio del Toro for no reason. But yeah, I mean, I think he delivered something pretty powerful. He was talking about kind of the importance of, you know, Neon and A24 being able to kind of manage to meet people's demands and give people living wages, even though kind of the big studios don't.
Well, you just put it as directly as you possibly can, which is like, if these smaller companies can do it, then why can't major studios?
Who make a lot more money,
like significantly more money.
Well, moving on next, I mean, Jack, you've already kind of touched upon this one. You were impressed by Maestro, I believe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, for context, it's the Leonard Bernstein biopic, who was a composer, maybe more familiar to American audiences because he did the talk show circuit and everything, had more of a familiar public persona for people over in the States. At least I hope I'm not projecting my own kind of, like, Bernstein ignorance. But obviously, did the songbook for West Side Story, was incredibly famous, one of the more famous composers in US history. And this is, I think, a fairly unconventional retelling of his life story. It's very knotty. He was, you know, he was queer in some way, whether it was bisexual or gay, but also had a wife and kids. And it was just one of those classic examples of a queer man living at that time, but couldn't, you know, fully embrace the queerness because it was impermissible politically, culturally. So it follows from, at some point in the 1940s, he did this great performance. He stepped in for a composer that was ill on the day.
For a conductor.
For a conductor, thank you. And then it just kind of goes from there and like retells his story in an unconventional manner, I think. And I just loved it. I thought it was really swoony, romantic, so incredibly well directed by Bradley Cooper, who's kind of like, I mean, for me, it's kind of like it's a level above A Star Is Born. I think A Star Is Born is so visually wonderful. There are so many great, you know, kind of like shot sequences, and the camera movement on some of the scenes is wonderful. It opens with this great scene where it's like it begins in black and white. And this opening scene is this like really lovely chiaroscuro where it's like really dark in some areas and really bright. And he's like, he wakes up in bed, gets the call that he's going to come down and step in for this composer, which is going to like, you know, set his career in motion. And he rips this curtain open. The whole room is like filled with light, and then it kind of like moves down into the auditorium where he's going to compose or conduct. I'm getting the two mixed up. The camera just shoots down into the conducting stand, and it's just really great. And I was just really taken by it. I've just rattled on so much.
No.
trying to get a bit of synopsis in there as well for context. But no, it's really great.
I feel like I'm understating it. Because I haven't actually seen this film yet, but you've got me so excited to see it. But what I do have for you in a maestro kind of arena is a Leonard Bernstein travel tip, if you'll indulge me. I was in New York in April, staying near the Greenwood Cemetery. Mm. Fantastic cemetery. I don't know how you feel about cemeteries.
Wait, next to or in?
Next to.
Okay.
Next to. Scoping it out. Future okay. Real estate. No. It's the kind of place I'd like to be buried. It's cherry blossom throughout, and Basquiat and Leonard Bernstein are buried there, so you can do a little pilgrimage to go and see them, which is exactly what I did, and it was gorgeous.
I imagine that'll be a very popular thing after Maestro comes out. What did you think?
I think there's a couple of things that kind of went a bit off in the edit where I felt that maybe kind of it felt a bit television, not cinema. I loved the first kind of segment that was the black and white one, and there were like plenty of moments, but there were a few things where I was just like, this scene doesn't quite fit here. But I would say, I mean, it kind of frames it both in the poster and in terms of who gets first billing as like, this is not actually just a Leonard Bernstein story. This is really a story about his wife, Felicia, who I wouldn't say is long suffering, because I think even though there is that issue of like a heteronormative marriage and a man that is queer because of this, you know, and dealing with that in the circumstances of his time, like they very, very much loved each other. I found that quite moving.
Yeah, I mean, Carey Mulligan's performance is fantastic. Like, really, really, really engaging. And it works on so many different emotional levels. When I walked out, I felt there was, like, this... just this great tragedy of circumstance where they're so... I mean, this wraps up towards the end. I'm trying not to speak too specifically on certain scenes. There are so many great scenes in there, including, like, a seven-minute sequence, which where he... Like, I think it's actually the first time you really see him conduct... And I know it's a real life event where he conducted this great performance in a cathedral, but the way that Cooper shoots it is just incredible. And yeah, like there's so much emotional depth to both of their performances, and it's just sad because this is kind of like a relationship that would have played out differently in different times.
And who would have guessed, right? Like 10 years ago, Bradley Cooper, the guy from The Hangover. It's crazy to me. The direction his career has gone in.
I know, and as much as there has been a little bit of controversy about the prosthetics online, I think they work. I think it's
great. Absolutely. Well, yeah, that's it. I don't think you'll, especially if you're more familiar with Bernstein, you're not going to kind of like walk away thinking, "Wow, that was so," you know, that was so identical or whatever. But no, it was theatrical and worked really well for me. I think there was more emotionality to it that I thought was more convincing, because it's not trying to like tell you his career, and like I said, like there's it's very sparse that you actually see him conduct or like see him working. It's more telling you the emotional story of his relationship and his, you know, exploration of his sexuality and things like that, but there are so many great scenes in there, so many great scenes.
agreed, and I was very impressed by a lot of the dialogue. I found it very moving. I laughed, yeah. I cried, I learned about conducting. Who could ask for anything more? Kappen, we could ask for something more on your next one. We're not kind of just doing highlights of the festival, and this is actually something that, like, I believe Little White Lies has chosen not to cover in any other
it's
sense.
It's a low light.
It's a low light, but I feel like we have to mention the fact that there were some controversial figures this year. There was Besson, there was Woody Allen, and there was Roman Polanski. Not a one got a good reception. And I believe the nadir was the Polanski, which you're going to tell us about.
Yeah, completely respect the decision not to review, but we're doing reportage here, right? And it is a big story that Polanski has been selected for this festival. Why? I really did think that the climactic scene of Ferrari was going to be the biggest car crash I saw while I was here, but it's the Polanski film, The Palace, which I did watch and is absolutely one of the worst films that I think I've seen, well, certainly at Venice, but in years, really. It's set in this luxury hotel on the eve of the millennium, and it feels like the script was written right around then as well. Like, the kind of humour that's in this movie is stuff like, oh my goodness, the old lady's little dog has gone into her luggage and pulled out a vibrator. Scandal! Like, it's that kind of really early 2000s sort of stuff about old ladies having plastic surgery and 80-year-old billionaires being horny for their young wife. I mean, it's distressing to me that these images will live in my brain forever, because it's also not forgettable. Like, it's so bad that it's seared into my brain. I really feel like someone needed to give Mickey Rourke better advice, because he appears in this movie as a kind of cross between Donald Trump and Hulk Hogan. He's this sort of mahogany colour with a blonde wig that hilariously gets blown off by a champagne cork at one point. And I don't think it's a spoiler. Well, it is a spoiler, but I don't mind spoiling this movie to say that the final shot of the film is a penguin humping a dog, or is the dog humping a penguin? I don't know. I'd lost the will to live by that point. But it's just one of those movies where people wander around kind of getting into farcical scrapes that are meant to be hilarious, and none of it works. None of it. I don't think it's meant to be a comedy, and there's probably a quote unquote joke in every scene. And I didn't like smile. It wasn't like I didn't laugh, I didn't smile. And, you know, Polanski obviously is a child rapist. So,
I mean, we don't even have to say allegedly. It's like, that's on record.
Oh, no,
he was convicted.
Obviously.
Yeah.
He admits it. It's insane to me that someone can make work that bad and have that history and still be playing at the Venice Film Festival. What the actual?
Yeah, well, the good vibes of the beach, we'll have to try and cancel that out in our minds, because that is truly depressing news. But I believe currently sitting at 0% on Rotten Tomatoes. So
it'll stay that way until somebody decides they can make a reputation for themselves off the back of positively reviewing this absolute dog shit. Can we swear? I mean, we should be allowed to swear about Roman Polanski, let's face it.
Yeah, I didn't see it, and I'd love to say that was like a grand political gesture, like a statement of defiance and all that. I was just too lazy and missed it. I went for drinks. I was like, I don't need to see this. I didn't see Jacques when it was here in 2019 as well. I don't need to watch a rapist film.
I thought it was going to reignite all that sort of tired old separating the arts and the artists debate, but it's like, what art? There's no art here.
But Jack, you, I believe, did find some art in, like, one of the smaller titles, a film called Horde?
I did, yeah, Horde, which was really good. I for context, I'm with GQ, and I profiled Joseph Quinn, who's the star of this film, at the end of last year. And, you know, that was kind of like when I got to the inevitable question towards the end of that conversation, where I was like, so what's coming next? What are you really excited for? It was just Horde for minutes on end. Like, she was so excited for the director, Luna Kamoun, and like for the star, the other star of the film, Sarah Lightfoot Leon, who are both, I think, debutantes. But it's great. It's kind of like the story is in the title in a way. So it's
And maybe we should clarify that it's Horrd.
Yes,
not
yes, yes, yes.
Horrd. For an audio audience.
Well, I mean, I was just about to clarify. So it's about a girl who grows up with her mom. I think it's in, I want to say it's around the 90s. It's a very 90s movie. It has that kind of like sensibility and style and aesthetic. And her mom is a hoarder. And, you know, the house is just, like, packed with, you know, piles of newspapers, and there's this one bit where the girl falls over and played by eventually later on played by Sarah Lightfoot Leon, like, who sticks her hand under one of the newspapers and finds a mound of dead rats all tied together like a rat king. It's really, really grim. So it kind of plays out in some ways like a typical coming of age. I think it follows with the recent trend in British cinema of, like, having these great women debut filmmakers coming out with these great coming of age movies, like How to Have Sex, like After Sun. Obviously they're thematically distinct, they're talking about different scenarios and situations, about different characters. This one was definitely the gnarliest, definitely the grossest, because there are, like, some elements of, like, real body horror in there. Like, there's this thing that she does, the protagonist, where she spits in her hand, or, like, spits in, like, this food in her hand and then eats it, because it's something that kind of, like, echoed through from her childhood. And it's all about the trauma that echoes through from the childhood, because things happen. Again, I don't want to spoil it. I think it's kind of, things happen in the first act, which then echo through later on in her life. And then Joseph Quinn bounds in, everybody's favourite Stranger Things star, and he's just excellent as I can't say it without spoiling, but for whatever reason he comes in, they have a knotty, strange, eerie relationship, I think. He kind of is simultaneously a brotherly figure, but then also somebody that she desires at this period of, like, late teendom. It kind of, like, toes the taboo line between an incestuous desire, and it's really in so many ways it's nasty and so singular. I thought it was such a calling card for Luna Kamoun, the director. Like, it's really visually very, very, very distinct from anything else I've seen from a debut. It's not without its flaws.
And you mentioned How to Have Sex. The director of How to Have Sex, Molly Manning Walker, shot this, she's sort of partly responsible for the look of this thing.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well, because I didn't. Knowing that shared relationship between the films, I wouldn't have been able to guess based on the style. I think they're quite distinct visually. I don't want to get too much into How to Have Sex, but no, it was Horde was really what a wonderful surprise, and I wasn't surprised that Joseph Quinn was so into it. I do also think that, like, Stranger Things fans, and, like, Joseph Quinn has obviously exploded with this insane stand-in since he played Eddie Munson in the fourth season of Stranger Things.
We were all at the party for Horde, he had to have a bodyguard. Many fans here.
There are. He's like the Harry Styles of this film, of this Venice. Don't worry, darling. I feel as though they're going to go in and be a little bit surprised and shocked by some of the content, because it is... You know what? We watched Poor Things as well, you know, obviously the Lanthimos, and there are elements of body horror in that. But, like, I was never squeamish with it. Yeah. With this, there were parts where I had to look away, and I was like, that's just really, really gross. Like, delightfully so. Like, delightfully gross out, and deliberately so. But no, I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, it does feel like... I so distinctly remember when one of my husband's colleagues was just a huge Jennifer Lawrence fan. And then she told me that she was going to just go, you know, in a very sweet, kind, not particularly edgy person. And then she was telling me that, like, because she loved Jennifer Lawrence, she was going to go see Mother that evening. So I wonder whether that's going to be similar, that there's going to be a load of Stranger Things fans that are just like, oh, great, the guy from the show is in the thing.
It's so funny when that happens, isn't it? Like, people off to see Equus in the West End because... Harry Potter's in it, that fan crossover stuff. I think it's great. I mean, there must be people who started as Twilight fans and have since seen some of the great auteurs of world cinema, because we're back to see Twilight with them.
And Kristen Stewart, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, both.
But we've got another smaller title from you, Catherine. Can you tell us about Tatami?
Yeah, so this is a fantastic film. It's playing in the Orizzonte sidebar at Venice, where you tend to find that it's not going to be like, it's not going to be Michael Mann. Thank God it's not going to be Polanski. This is a co-directed film from Guy Nativ and Zaha Amir Ebrahimi. Now, she was the lead in Holy Spider a couple of years ago. Really interesting film. Yeah. And she's also in this as an actor. It's a kind of a two-hander between her and Ariane Mandy. They both play women who are experts in judo. One is the coach, one is the judo champion. It's the Judo World Championships, and they're representing Iran. And they start to do really well. And you think, oh, great, you know, this is wonderful news for their country. Not so fast. Iran are concerned that if she does too well, if their champion does too well, she might face Israel in the final championship. And the problem is, because those two countries are in conflict, from Iran's perspective, the possibility of losing to Israel is so horrifying that the government agents ring up and ask her to throw the match or withdraw or pretend to be injured to avoid this sort of possible humiliation. She doesn't want to throw the match, obviously.
Right.
So what you have here is, I don't think I've ever seen anything that's sort of quite this combination of like a thrilling sports movie. The judo is filmed fantastically, really kinetic cinematography from Todd Martin. And then the politics of it are just incredibly gripping and realistic and well-researched and you know, coming from an authentic place with these filmmakers. So it's almost like you get the kind of the excitement of a sports movie combined with the legitimacy and social justice and kind of campaigning aspects of a political film, which, I mean, they both work really well. Like, we've all sat through sports movies where you're kind of going like, well, this is quite entertaining and I'm into the boxing, but do I really buy this bit in the third act where they're like, actually, I'm not going to fight the big fight? You're like, yeah, you're going to fight the big fight. And the kind of marrying it to this very serious, very realistic political kind of context, it just gave it so much meat and heft. And similarly, I think we've all sat through movies that are trying to draw our attention to a social injustice, but they're not exactly a gripping time to watch.
Yeah.
So, and it melds those two elements brilliantly. I really enjoyed it.
That sounds fantastic. I mean, like, there really has been quite a great bit of world cinema. I mean, it's tricky covering this festival because obviously, you know, you want to kind of get your commissions, you want to kind of do the things that are going to be the, you know, biggest titles and get the things that people are most excited about. But I feel like Venice is the festival for undiscovered gems. Like, last year it was Saint-Omer, I think, that people were just kind of, like, blown away by. Like, this is really a festival in which these kind of, there's a bit of space to breathe, so you can kind of word of mouth things that are brilliant can actually get their time in the sun.
They've got some great programmers, and I think this is actually happening in sidebars, you know, across the board at festivals these days. But you've got people like Beatrice Florentino programming the Settimana, the Venice Critics Week. You've got people like Gaia Furra programming Venice Days. I think she's the first female director of that strand that we've had. Over at Cannes, you've got people like Ava Cahan programming Cannes Critics Week. It's a really interesting time for festivals. It feels like they're finally shaking off the idea that some people have to have been doing this stuff for 40 years before they get put in charge of things. It feels to me like it is becoming more egalitarian and more about taste and have you got the goods. It's really interesting.
And like, Jack, I know you were saying yesterday that you thought that this maybe has been collectively like the strongest lineup that you've seen for, you know, amongst all of the festivals that you've been to, this has been like one of the top contenders.
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't been as adventurous or curious as I'd like to ordinarily be. I'm also kind of treating this as a bit of a holiday. So I've been like spending a lot of days at the beach and like yesterday afternoon, I missed the Hamaguchi because I was watching Arsenal v Man United. I'm so sorry. I got very drunk. So thankfully I didn't then go to the Hamaguchi because I would have lessened everybody else's experience, I'm sure. But no, it's been really, really great. I mean, I don't think I've seen anything that I've really disliked. I've seen at least three films, inclusive of Maestro, Poor Things, we're not talking about now, and actually Priscilla, which we will get onto, which I was just really blown away by. A segue to talk about Priscilla.
Yeah, Time Like the Present. Yeah. What did you think of Priscilla, Sofia Coppola's biopic of Priscilla Presley?
Well, I was just so disappointed. No. it's so terrible. I'm actually not much of a Coppola girly in a way. I mean, my relationship to her personally is kind of gone a bit backwards, where like when I was a teenager I remember watching Marie Antoinette and you know, kind of like some of the more undersung movies around then, but then I didn't watch like The Virgin Suicides until maybe like a month ago, And I watched it and I was like, this is great.
Yeah,
great
movie. Turns
great
out.
Movie. Also watched watched
Stone
Somewhere.
Cold Take.
Yeah, thanks.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. I'd heard the whispers always go around in festivals, right, about these movies before they come out, because they do get pre-screened for certain very specific critics and journalists. There's also distributor screenings, as you were saying earlier. And the word for Priscilla that was kind of like going around was it wasn't, you know, maybe a bit off, a bit mid. I'd heard from people kind of like through Chinese whispers that like some people really hated it. So maybe it was a product of the fact that I was going in with lowered expectations, but it was really fantastic. Like immediately top tier Coppola. Hmm. I guess I should then... Right. Is that what it's about?
Are you including Francis Ford when you're talking about Coppola? Dr. Sophia Coppola?
No, we're talking about Tops Off, I guess. Okay. But yeah, and in case you don't know who Priscilla Presley is, it's about her relationship with Elvis, basically. Elvis Presley, of course. and it kind of maps their relationship from when they meet in Germany, when she is like a very young teenager.
Yeah, they specify ninth grade, but I'm not really sure with American ages what that means.
She's like 14,
oh, okay.
I think. Yeah. I mean, don't... I'm not sure about the history, but I think in the film she's around 14 when they first meet, and it just kind of plays with like the inherent creepiness of their relationship to begin with because of the age gap, without battering you over the head with it, and also conjuring a bit of taboo sympathy for Elvis in a way, especially with that first act and like bleeding into the second. Eventually, you know, spoiler alert, he does some really monstrous things, which are both a product of the times and the kind of like the gender norms and standards of like Mad Men 1950s, 60s America, where, you know, he's very much like overbearing, literally so, because he's 6'5", and like whenever he's around the lead is Priscilla, Kaylee Spaney, by the way, is fantastic.
Yeah. I
really, really, really thought she was so gripping and emotionally dexterous and everything. I thought the performance was fantastic. And also, like, very credible in all of the different ages that she plays. Like, when she's playing a young teenager, she feels like a 12-year-old. And when she's playing older, because it maps through to, I think, the 70s when Elvis was in Vegas.
Yeah.
As everybody knows from the movie Elvis by Baz Luhrmann. She places within those kind of... she leaps the generations so credibly, so convincingly. And yeah, it's a really knotty and kind of gross film in some ways, but then it's also just quite tragic. And I don't think it, I personally didn't feel as though it kind of places kind of like a moral judgment on anybody for any of their misdeeds or any of like the questionable relationships or stuff within the movie, whilst also drawing attention to the fact that Priscilla Presley, by dint of the time and by dint of the kind quite self-interested person that she was in a relationship with, you know, had a really rough time of it.
Yeah.
But the thing that I was most impressed by is it doesn't then descend into vilifying Elvis for it. You know, I mean, I think as far as I can recall, I think the Presley family didn't want to have his music in the film, right?
Because Priscilla Presley was a executive producer, and it is based on the book that she wrote, Elvis and Me, which is a kind of biography of their time together.
Right.
But yes, the Elvis estate did not allow them kind of free access to all of the song archives in the way that they did with Baz Luhrmann's Elvis.
Well, yeah, and I think it works to great effect. I mean, be
it's
by Kismet, because it's not really about him.
I'm sure if they could have got the rights to the songs, it would have been slathered in them. But there's something very particular about the way that you're inhabiting her world, not
exactly
his world. It's in the Baz Luhrmann, it makes sense that those songs are kind of bone-deep part of the text, because it is about him. But I think if you're going to make a movie about her, there's a certain sort of logic to it not being drenched in Elvis's songs. We're in her headspace. Mm-hmm. She's not the creator of those recordings. And I think that plays really, really nicely. That's one of the things I sort of liked about it, even though I'm sure it was kind of a necessity as the mother of invention type of choice.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the film does other great things to kind of communicate and convey like the Elvis mania of the time anyway. It's like, Priscilla is constantly surrounded by like the Elvis groupies, right? And there's a very pointed comparison between his relationship to his like female fans and how much he kind of like saps like sucks energy and sucks like so much ego from that, But then, you know, then also the same kind of has like kind of like the same thing, but very specifically with Priscilla.
It'll make a lovely companion piece to Behind the Candelabra.
Yeah, totally.
The Michael Douglas biopic of Liberace, which we see from the perspective of his lover, played by Matt Damon, who was this young guy, very starry-eyed, very kind of couldn't believe his luck when this famous man, who was so wealthy, showed an interest in him. And then gradually the famous person starts to make over the younger person in their image. There's a bit of that in Priscilla. He's telling her how to dress. He's telling her how he wants her to behave. And it's, you know, it is creepy. And I think one of the things that I think works about Sofia Coppola as a filmmaker is how good she is with objects.
Yeah.
You know, a false eyelash, stocking in the post, the texture of carpet that we see perfectly manicured toenails sinking into. She's very good on all of that, and sometimes I think it can be a problem in her filmmaking, but for something like this it sort of works really well, because we're dealing with a main character who was treated as an object, as a doll, as an accessory by the person who ostensibly loved her most.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, I did very much relate to one scene in the film, in that, like, when I was giving birth for the first time, I got a blow dry. I got my spent an hour on my makeup. I wanted my baby to think I was pretty. I was all done up to the nines. I wore my fanciest stuff.
That's so funny. Gosh.
It's an instinct that you can have. But yeah, I really like the tone that it struck, because whilst it can kind of acknowledge, like, yes, like the creepiness, the difficulty of this relationship, and the sort of like really tough power dynamic that's going on in it, like, it still kind of captures, like, that this is like a teenage dream come true for a young woman, and like how magical so much of it, that, like, oh my god, Elvis comes and you become his, like, obsession, and like how wonderful that could feel.
Yeah, it's interesting. It feels like one of the themes of the festival has been possessive men.
Yeah.
We saw it in Poor Things, which is probably my favourite film at the festival so far. There's a bit of that in Ferrari. Mm. It's all over Priscilla. It's in the Woody Allen film.
Which it's in The Beast.
Which I don't really get into here, but yeah.
Yeah. But I think what's really deft about it, though, is that, like, even though it highlights, you know, her loss of autonomy and how overbearing he was and all of these kind of things, like, isn't averse to sympathising with him at the same time. Mm. And sympathising with a very, very particular kind of life experience. I mean, like, within the first dozen lines you get from Elvis, he's talking about his mum having literally died the year prior, which is covered in depth in Elvis. And I think there will be a lot of people cross-comparing the two texts, because they've come, like, within a year of each other.
Yeah. I think to both advantage,
yeah,
I have to say.
Totally. Talk about companion pieces. Yeah. I mean, like, and a lot of people are going to be comparing Jacob Elordi and Austin Butler as well. And I love how they have completely different interpretations of the same, you know, monolithic cultural figure. Because, like, with Elordi, he's kind of like, you know, I wouldn't say that either performance is better or more credible or more interesting or whatever, but, like, I like how Elordi is, like, kind of like he's quite a gross guy. Like, half the film he spends in bed, and, like, he's just kind of like, there's this one great scene, I loved it, where it's just that his idea of, like, a really romantic time together with Priscilla is just staying in bed and watching movies and eating food. And it just kind of cuts between them in, like, this very lush, kind of ornate, kind of baroque bed in this bedroom, it feels like it must stink because they've been in there for such a long time. And, like, it just cuts to, like, this tray of food coming to the door, and then it'll cut to, like, the food being gone, and then they're all in bed, like, you know, smoking cigarettes and, you know, watching movies on the TV, and it's like, it just feels really grim.
Yeah.
But then for him, who's, you know, is also, you know, kind of drug addled and all this kind of stuff, like, he was, like, for him, that was, like, his kind of, like, his bliss mode, you know, but also because he didn't want to go outside because he was constantly harassed by people whenever he left the house. Like,
I gotta say,
whenever Elvis left the building.
Assuming laundry is being done and taking away the drug addle, that's my idea of my dream week as well. Room service, movies, and staying in bed for a week with, like, a beautiful person with a giant beehive, or kind of some, like, 6-foot man with a big quiff. I don't believe I felt that grim.
Movies. It's one of the best times.
This is the really what distinguishes, I think, two types of people: the people that want to eat in bed and the people that don't.
Yeah,
and
I'm people that want to go outside. Yeah, maybe it just seemed quite smelly to me.
Criticism taken on board in two respects.
Let us know. Write in. Are you a food in bed person?
But before we wrap up, we've got some more titles coming next week. Some of them we've hinted at. But do you have anything left that you're seeing in the festival that you're particularly excited about?
I have a little annual tradition. I mean, I'm calling it a tradition. I started this last year. They seem to always play an Ozu film in the classics strand, and it's quite nice after engaging with films about which you know nothing going in. I mean, that's one of the great pleasures of film festivals. But it's quite nice after that to go into just something that was made 50 years ago that maybe you haven't seen before. I'll be off checking out the Ozu in classics.
Yeah, as we speak, Hannah Strong, digital editor, is like avoiding the fact that it is a beautiful day and the beach is available to go and watch the Friedkin.
The Exorcist. Is it? Yeah.
Yes, not the new Friedkin, the Exorcist, and you know, can't criticize her for that. It's a great one.
Well, they also did a screening. Maybe this wasn't public, but they did a screening at like 11 in the morning. I was like, why would you want to watch The Exorcist at 11? Like, it feels like a firmly like midnight, maybe like 10 o'clock movie, unless it's Halloween. Like,
this is the other creepy. Two types of people, I suppose. It's the bed eaters, the non-bed eaters, the 11 a.m. Exorcist people, where it's just like, that sounds wonderful, and then the Jacks of the world.
And then, like, yeah, for me, films I'm really looking forward to, it's Hitman, the Richard Linklater film later, because I just, like, really like Linklater, even though he's a bit hit and miss recently. I need to see the Hamaguchi film as well.
Yeah.
Evil Does Not Exist, is that right?
Yes.
I think people saw it last night, everybody was raving about it. I'm seeing it at a screening tomorrow.
Yes.
Because like I said, I was watching football.
No, I'll be with you at the Richard Linklater. I disagree that he's hit and miss. I love them all. Well, is that true? I've just put that on record.
That could be another podcast, wouldn't it?
Like. But thank you both very much. This has been awesome. And have a really wonderful rest of the festival. And more time on the beach and more time watching great movies and less Polanski, please.
Yes, please.
Yes. Cheers.
So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, it's a hybrid of a Venice special and a return to normal programming. I'll be discussing some of the other big titles and doing our two regular review slots too. We have Pablo Larraín's reimagining of Pinochet Chile in El Conde, moving romance past lives, and an interview with its incredible director Celine Song, and you'll be getting more hot takes about the hottest films in Venice. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif. My guests this week were Catherine Bray and Jack King. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.